Hi, everybody. I'm going to talk about what is very much a group effort about parent-mediated interventions with underrepresented populations. And the organization of my talk is I'm going to talk very quickly about disparities in healthcare and ASD in terms of identification and treatment, things I think you all know about. And then disparities in inclusion in research. What are the barriers to participation in research for underrepresented families? What are models that we might think of in terms of how to include families into intervention, and what are we looking for? And then I'm going to take one study, which is Temba Carr's dissertation, and use that as an example of some of the things that happened to us as we tried to do an intervention study for an underrepresented group, and then talk about broader implications. So just very quickly, this is a slide that shows the prevalence rate ratio among 8-year-old children, which includes the newest, I think this works, newest CDC data from 2008, and just the idea that African-American families are represented less often. We find fewer African-American families who have children with autism compared to Caucasian children, and these are just across four of the main states. It looked like this discrepancy was going down from compared to 2000, but in fact it's remained stable in the last 6 years. Another similar data set, although this is actually the prevalence rates of ASD in the San Francisco Bay Area, and you can see that it affects ethnic minorities, racial minorities, young mothers, and less well-educated parents are also represented less often. And then we also have data that shows that, in this case, African-American families have more complaints or concerns about how, this is with children with ASD, how they are treated by the medical system in terms of how long their doctors listen to them and how sensitive people are to their situations. I think that it's particularly striking, and why we're all here today, is that families that are less represented also tend to be studied less often. So we really have a vicious cycle where people that need the most services don't get them, and we don't study them, and so we don't know what to do to make things better. And I don't know, how much you can see this, but one of the things we were really struck by in our longitudinal study, which followed 200 children referred for possible autism 20 years ago, is that the families, African-American families, especially those, and so this, the darker blue is African-American and the lighter blue are Caucasian families, and this is just the number of hours of treatment they received between ages 2 and 5. And there's also an interaction with, obviously, with education. But, look at this. This is like a tenfold difference in terms of sheer number of hours. And most of these kids were actually in North Carolina, where they had access to public services, but they got less. So what are the barriers? And I think here I'm going to focus on barriers to participation in research, but I think many of the same barriers also pertain to participation in interventions. And many of these things are very practical issues. I mean, how far away do you have to go to get services? Or how far away does someone have to go to get to you to get services? The availability of service providers who will work in rural areas or in inner cities, the cost of the services, and family factors, such as the fact that both parents are working, or neither parent is working, or they're taking care of other kids, all sorts of issues. We also have, even when we do get families into studies or into interventions, we often lose families quickly. And this may be partly because of the time commitment. It may be because of wait lists. People just give up. There may be no clear incentives for families to participate, or they may expect things that are not really what they're going to get. And people feel like we don't necessarily understand the cultures from which they are coming. So I think many of us respond to this with the idea that we're going to look at child factors and family factors, and that these contribute, that ultimately maybe we can change these by making the caregivers more comfortable with what they're doing, give them ways to improve the family environment, which will improve the child's level of impairment, and in the end actually result in both a happier caregiver, but also a child who's doing better. And I think that we have very high expectations for what's going to happen in the family, in part because that's the easiest place for us to see where we can start. So we, in Michigan, we were doing a lot of intervention studies where we were a site for other people's interventions. And one of the things that we discovered was that many families could not or would not participate in relatively long, intense interventions. They were appalled when we said, you know, do you want to be randomized into this study? Guess what? You were. We will be working with you for 2 years and coming to your house twice a day, 5 days a week. So one of the things that we decided was we had families who were like, are you serious that we wanted to have something for families who could not or would not participate in these studies. We also were participating in studies where the age cutoff was very young. It might be 30 months or 24 months. And many families, as you know, from minorities or less well-educated parents don't get identified until their children are older. So we decided that we would create an intervention for families that either couldn't sustain the length of time or whose kids were a little bit older, who were missing the boat. And this was a family where the families were eligible for this study if they had no more than some college, which seems high, but the reality is many of these, almost all mothers, had graduated from high school and had taken a course or two in something. With relatively low mean incomes, so I'll show you that in a minute, who had kids between the ages of 2 and 4. And our strategies for addressing the barriers that I showed you were to see the kids at home, compensate families for travel to assessments, have a broader age, and not require that the parent was alone at home with the child when we came. So other kids could be there, both parents could be involved, grandparents could be involved. I mean, many of the more focused interventions really require an identified caregiver. We also wanted to speed up how families got in, have a shorter treatment so that people would participate, not expect people to do 25 hours a week of independent work with their kids, tolerate cancellations, and we did give families money for coming in for the assessment, not for participating in the treatment. And then we really wanted to, and all of us, I think, always say this, meet individual families' needs. We wanted to do a better job of recognizing what did families say they wanted. And what that meant was in this intervention, which really emphasizes social communication and kind of hopes that behavior problems will be resolved through family communication, we went ahead and said, ask people, what are you having the most trouble with? And we will address that directly, rather than hoping it would go away if everything else got better. We also decided that our bottom line was that not only were we going to have nice, positive social interactions with the families and teach them how to create communicative opportunities, but that we were going to get these families into community services, and that that was as important as modeling how you follow your child's lead and how you build communicative opportunities. And so that, if the therapist had to spend the hour on the phone with a parent and somebody in early on to get them in, that was a higher priority. Okay. So the eligibility criteria, again, this is just for ESICO, so this is modeled on Amy Weatherby and Julian Wood's early social interaction treatment. CO, excuse me, is for community outreach. And our hope was really to change the caregiver's behavior. So we had an assessment, we had a baseline where we wanted to video the family 3 times. And we told them, if we can come 3 days in a row, we'll be there and this will be over and we'll start. We used a multiple baseline intervention, and families were seen, or we attempted to see the families twice a week at home, and we sent out on a third day someone to video what they were doing when we weren't there. So over the course of 12 weeks, they would have gotten 24 sessions. Then they had another assessment, and then follow-up, we saw them once a month for 3 more months with another assessment. Actually, I think you can't see this at all, but we started with 14 families. We had one family that was excluded because they didn't show up to the initial assessment, and we could never find them again. We then had 13 families. 3 families refused after the assessment because they said this was too much burden, and 1 got into a center-based program that was much more intensive. So we had 9 families enter treatment. 1 family was discontinued because we discovered, or I discovered in the middle of this, that they actually did not speak English. And our therapists were trying to do the best they can, but it was really not going very far. So we ended up with 8 families completed. And I think the point here is we started with 14, we ended up with 8. And that is a much lower rate of participation than we normally had in Michigan, where there are not great services. And then here, what I want you to see is just the average age of the moms was about 31. We had African American and Caucasian families. Some people were married and some people weren't. Again, we have this a lot of mothers who graduated from high school or who had some college, many fathers who did not graduate from high school, and then very low annual incomes. So saying you've had some college does not guarantee you an income in which you could survive. What was that? Well, I'm just going to keep plowing ahead. These families had quite a few kids. So the average was 2.5 children. The kids were about 28 months when we started. And what we did was we used a multiple baseline, which may have been an insane thing to do, but we took the 8 different areas of intervention for Amy's intervention. There are 8 things like chores, play without toys, play with toys. And we picked 2 targets, which we always did first, which were snack and something related to washing, washing some body part. Then we, the parents picked another target that they wanted to work on, and we randomly picked of the remaining areas the 4th. So we then had, when someone came into the house once a week and videoed when we weren't there, they videoed the parent participating in 8 of these different activities. And that was the craziest thing we did. But that allowed us to see change over time in the targeted and non-targeted activities. And the measure that we used was looking at these videotapes when we weren't there, and we measured caregiver fidelity. So how many opportunities did the family, did the mother or whoever it was, give the child to communicate? Did they pause? Was this a balanced interaction? And our mastery was defined as 70% of what they could possibly do, which is lower than normal, but almost nobody ever got above 70%. And they had to do this 2 in a row. And then we would shift to a new target. Our hypothesis was that families with fewer resources would be more likely to discontinue participation earlier on or have lower treatment attendance, and that they might cancel more often, and that canceling would be related to less progress. And here are just, I just put 4 of these on here, the first 4 families. And you can see how long it took them to participate in the intervention. So the green should have taken ideally 2 weeks. The yellow should have happened over 3 months, And then the red is follow-up, which should have also been 3 months. So we're really talking about a period of, 6 months with an extra 2 weeks. And in fact, we often, and these families actually are shorter than the next four, took actually up to 10 months, and we have another family that took all of a year. So this meant that families were canceling sessions. This just shows you treatment cancellations, again, just for 4 of the 8 families, over 30 times, another 25. Another one, only 7. So really, these are little kids, and you would expect some. And these are parent reports of how much time they spent using our techniques with their children. And you'll see that there's actually a negative. I mean, it's sort of bizarre. The more they canceled, the more they said they did this with their children. So our next hypothesis was that families would use these transactional supports, these strategies to communicate during targeted activities, more than non-targeted, at least for the first part of the intervention. But then what we hoped to see was generalization, so that after a month or so, that they would start to use these techniques even in the non-targeted activities. And that we hope that the gains that were made during our intervention would be sustained through follow-up. And this is just, I just picked some examples that are relatively clear. So we had some cases. This is the mother changing a child's diaper, which she picked as her at one of the activities. And the fact that she was talking to him more, she was pausing, she was making this fun, she had goals in her head of what she wanted. And you can see with the red that this is going up, and then it's matched to one of the non-targeted activities that's not changing. We also had situations where there was no effect. You can see that sometimes things are going down, or sometimes the non-target is going up faster than the target, and an example of generalization. And when we put this all together, you can see that the effect sizes are not super high, but we did get, especially in the first half, the targeted activities, the moms did more of the transactional supports than they did in the non-targeted, and by the end of the study, they were equal, which is what we wanted. And we did get some effects at follow-up, although not great, and I'm gonna just zip through this. This shows the average transactional support score. So these are scored from videos, from somebody blind to everything. And you can see that they are higher, which is what we want in the targeted versus non-targeted activities, and they are higher at follow-up. Again, just 8 subjects. We did not manage to change the kids' IQ scores in this study. We weren't really expecting to, so this is Mullins before and after, or the Vineland scores. So this is a good example of the stability of these measures over a 6-month period. We also had, what is interesting in just classic intervention research, this is the children's behaviors. This is using a new measure called the ADOS-C, where we code social aspects of the child's behavior with the mother in those videotape sessions when the interventionist was not there. And we divided kids up into higher and lower IQ, lower meaning below 70. And you can see that the ADOS-C is like the regular ADOS, higher is worse or more abnormal. So in the targeted activities, this is not significant, but if anything happened, we made the lower ability kids worse. I mean, on the whole, it's not, thank God it's not significant, but in the non-targeted activities, the higher kids got a little better. Again, the interaction is significant. So we did not do a great job of changing the kids' behavior, and I think we have to think really seriously about what went wrong here, or what happened. Was it that the parents were too constrained, the parents of the less able kids, in doing these activities and made everybody more tense, even though the mothers were doing what we'd asked them to do because we showed they changed, yet the kids were having a hard time? And then the good news is that we actually were able to succeed with all of the families in terms of getting them into various services. And that was the bottom line, and that did happen with everyone in various ways. And it wasn't just making a phone call to a school, because often the families didn't want to go to that school, or the bus wouldn't come where they were, or you can imagine the complexities of negotiating this, mostly rural Michigan families. We also did an exit interview with the parents, asking them what did they get and not get, and what didn't they like about the intervention. Parents really stressed two things: that they better understood what was going on with their child, and they felt more empowered to deal with their community, and more aware and willing to participate in community activities that they'd always been eligible for. Okay. And they complained about scheduling and just having to be home, okay? So, attrition was high, cancellation rates were high. I think a big issue is just sustainability of this program. The parents did change in the way that they interacted with the targets. It wasn't clear that often the changes were gradual. Sometimes they were very quick, and people just got what we were telling them, and we really didn't need to keep doing it for months. The changes in the children's behavior did not seem to be related to the changes in the mother's behavior, which sounds very much like, for example, the PAC trial. There was an effect of nonverbal IQ. Lower kids are harder to work with, and that seemed to affect how much they changed and what happened with the mothers. And the parents really did use the things that we wanted them to use in terms of the community. So I'm going to just let you figure out the implications and stop. Thank you. Okay.